The State Department is seriously concerned about what it calls extreme measures of unwarranted repression slapped down in the Dominican Republic. It appears to be a revengeful policy aimed at everyone who may not have been in sympathy with the 31-year-old dictatorship, and not a mere matter of ferreting out the perpetrators of the assassination. Diplomatic circles fear these new repressions may be the orders of Major General Rafael Trujillo Jr., the new commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Most informed observers feel that the rise to power of the 32-year-old playboy could turn out to be the most fateful and the most unfortunate move that has been made since the death of the Generalissimo. The young general has never been popular, even with the most important supporters of his late father. He has shown no capacity for leadership or serious responsibility, and he certainly inspires little confidence or respect outside of the country. The government of President Balaguer and the military would have been much more likely to bridge the gap and ease the nation toward less despotic ways. The rise of the young Trujillo is an unmistakable attempt to perpetuate the dynasty, the family, and it will further enrage the opposition. This can only result in unnecessary turmoil. The State Department and leaders in the Organization of American States sense this responsibility. A few hours ago, the State Department called on the OAS to send an investigating team to the Dominican Republic to prevent further bloodshed. President Romulo Betancourt of Venezuela has called for an urgent meeting of the hemisphere body. This is Edward Tomlinson.
After his talks with President de Gaulle, President Kennedy says he has increased confidence as he moves tomorrow to Vienna to meet Khrushchev. He bases this confidence on what he and de Gaulle consider the highly satisfactory outcome of their meeting. President Kennedy cited to reporters today some of the potential strengths of the West in the conflict with communism. With American aid, Western Europe has staged a fantastic economic recovery from the war's destruction. Forgetting ancient rivalries, it is engaged in an historic movement toward economic and political unity. By wise policies, Britain and France are rapidly converting their empires into free associations of independent nations. On the communist side, Soviet Russia has gained nuclear weapons that destroy the former U.S. atomic monopoly and encourage the Reds to test and probe and push the West. But because of the extraordinary rebirth of Western European strength, the Reds have switched their threat to the southern half of the globe and are relying on subversion as their weapon instead of massed land armies. Mr. Kennedy moves to Vienna confident that this new threat can be thwarted if, by full cooperation and wise policies, the West mobilizes its assets to fulfill its responsibilities. Khrushchev is waiting in Vienna, where he says he hopes relations between the Soviet Union and the West can be built on a firm basis of peace and positive cooperation. This sounds like the same spirit that prevailed in Paris. In fact, it is a deliberate camouflage for the aggressive ambitions of communism. It would be unrealistic to expect Mr. Kennedy's words to change Khrushchev's convictions of inevitable communist victory at this time. But it is his belief that if the West unitedly meets the challenge, communism will be stopped no matter what Khrushchev thinks. This is David Will.
President Kennedy this afternoon finished his talks with General de Gaulle full of good humor and confidence regarding his upcoming meeting with Khrushchev. It was another rainy day, not good going for anybody, particularly for five dashing Paris motorcycle police who piled up in a sort of Indianapolis Speedway-type crash at Saint-Cloud as they were escorting President Kennedy back from a visit to the Shape military headquarters this morning. The impression here is that no matter how strenuously and successfully or unsuccessfully our president may have battled for closer cooperation from General de Gaulle, this struggle has been just a warm-up for the weekend tussle ahead. No matter what his mood, and there's ample reason to expect it to be ugly, Nikita Khrushchev is a formidable opponent, and one not to be taken cheaply. President Kennedy seems fully aware of this, and this evening, with the majestic phrases of de Gaulle's classic French still echoing in his ears, the heavy planning for the Vienna contest is underway. The presidential sparring partner is working with him tonight to make him razor sharp for the heavyweight diplomatic battle of the century, includes some of our best talent. Secretary of State Dean Rusk, a seasoned strategist, has hustled in overnight from Washington. Averill Harriman, somewhat battle-weary from several weeks of hand-to-hand diplomatic sparring in Geneva, is full of first-hand tips on the latest Soviet tactics. Ambassador Thompson, fresh from Moscow, is here to tell the president exactly what Khrushchev told him the other day about the problems that he'd like to settle. Mr. Kennedy will certainly not lack for advice. This is Bill Henry in Paris.
New York Congressman William Miller took over the chairmanship of the Republican Party today, serving notice that the Kennedy administration can expect no soft treatment. He lost no time in declaring war on the administration's handling of domestic and foreign problems. Miller told the party's national committee that if the United States had a parliamentary system, there would be a resounding vote of no confidence in the administration. Miller was elected to head the party by unanimous vote after State Chairman Ray Bliss of Ohio bowed out of the race. Miller promised he will not use the office to promote any one of the prospective presidential candidates. He said unless the GOP can make gains at the lower levels, the presidential nomination in 64 won't be worth very much to anyone. Miller said Republicans should speak up on foreign policy issues while the programs are being formed. He said the party should take a firm position now against admitting Red China to the United Nations. He also opposed the tractor for prisoner trade proposed by Cuban dictator Castro. He said if ransom is to be paid, we should think of the millions behind the Iron Curtain. We cannot afford to build up the strength of our enemies by the payment of ransom. Miller predicted that Republicans will win control of the House of Representatives next year and will make gains in the Senate. The new chairman began his career as a district attorney under former New York Governor Thomas E. Dewey. In his 11 years in Congress, he has earned a reputation as a rough-and-tumble campaigner, a good phrase-maker, and a skillful organizer. He is the first Catholic to hold the chairmanship in this century. As last year's chairman of the House Campaign Committee, he chalked up a gain of 22 House seats while the Republicans were losing the White House. This is Ned Brooks.
Scientists are continuing their discussions of the proposed U.S. program for putting a man on the moon at an estimated cost of somewhere between $20 and $40 billion. And here and there are voices of doubt that the project is worth the price. Yesterday, we reported some reservations on the part of Dr. Ralph E. Lapp, the prominent nuclear physicist. Today, United Press International reports that Dr. Philip Abelson, director of the Geophysical Laboratory of the Carnegie Institution and president of the Washington Academy of Sciences, holds similar views. Dr. Abelson, like Dr. Lapp, doubts that so much money should be spent putting a man on the moon when lunar exploration could be conducted at a fractional cost by electronic instruments. Scientists, quite naturally, can be expected to be much more eager for a moon probe than laymen, because of their interest in any new field of knowledge. So when they start doubting the value of the program, we have only a taste of what is to come when congressional committees, which will have to vote the funds, start toting up the costs. When the congressmen are faced with the startling fact that the moon trip may cost more than it costs to build our entire railway system, and perhaps nearly half the value of all the nation's farmlands, they may begin to have some serious doubts as to where we are going and why.